Beautiful. I love our being able to sit together, and I was aware during the sit that I had wished I had woven into the instructions that sometimes in working with thoughts, noting, planning, judging, comparing, as identifying the patterns can be really useful. So I'm going to continue this into next week because I was aware that of doing that myself, of just noting the patterns of the mind, and wish that I had brought that in. So I'm going to play with that again next week. And as you might have figured out, kind of what I want to have us explore together today is this, how do we work with the mind and the amazing gifts and tools that this practice gives us in a way of, and for today, looking at our relationship to beauty. And in part, this is inspired by listening to John O'Donohue's interview with Krista Tippett. And the interview, I think, was in, oh, I think he passed away in 08. So I'm not sure when that interview was. But John O'Donohue is definitely on the list of, like, if I could have dinner with five people who have since passed on, he would be one of the five. Just the Celtic former priest and philosopher and astonishing poet. And part of what I love about the way he writes and speaks, and I was also able to, I found an interview or a conversation between Sharon Salzberg and John O'Donohue that was lovely. But his skill with words and the evoking certainly of the Irish landscape, of which seems baked into his bones. But in this conversation with Krista Tippett, it's sort of on beauty and landscape, and both the, as I've mentioned in our, in that arriving sit, sort of what's our, that interior landscape. And often I'll ask the question among us, sort of what's the interior weather pattern? And this reflection on what's happening inside as a conversation with what's happening outside. Yes, it's with an O, D-O-N-O-A. And the way in which we can be in conversations with our, with the natural world, and are not, the absence of those conversations, I feel like, is at our peril. He has a beautiful line in this conversation with Krista Tippett, if I can find it. Yeah, where he's speaking about where he grew up. It's right there on the edge of the ocean as well. So the conversation, an ancient conversation between the ocean and stone that's going on, because where he grew up, there's a lot of limestone. And just that imaging of the conversation between the ocean and the limestone. And for those of us, wherever we are in the natural, wherever we are living in urban settings or suburban or exurbs or wherever we are, that there is a conversation happening between the landscapes, and allowing ourselves to drop into being a part of those conversations and the beauty that can then come. He is speaking. When you wake in the morning, you come out of your house, whether you believe you're walking into a dead geographical location, which is used to get to a destination, or whether you're emerging out into a landscape, there's just as much as, if not more, as alive as you, but in a totally different form. And if you go towards it with an open heart and a real watchful reverence, you will absolutely amazed at what it will reveal to you. And I think that one of the recognitions of the Celtic imagination, that landscape wasn't just matter, it was actually alive. And what amazes me about landscape recalls you into a mindful mode of stillness, solitude, silence, where you can truly receive time. It says it's not just a matter of the outer presence of landscape. I mean, dawn goes up and twilight comes, and even the most roughest inner city place. In this way, to not fall into the trap, well, if I don't live somewhere that is stunningly beautiful, I can't be a part of this conversation. Like, yes, you can. The sun will rise, the colors of the sunrise will be there, the twilight will come, the colors of the sunset will come. And how can we orient the mind to looking towards beauty and that which is alive? And a few months ago, I spoke about this from the book Braiding Sweetgrass, in which the author references that the English language is 70% nouns. We're for English, it's a culture of material things. The indigenous language, her lineage is of the Potawatomi language, is 70% verbs. Things are alive. And from the Celtic view, it's the same thing. Things are alive. And allowing ourselves to drop into the sense of aliveness, to engage with, be in conversation with that which is beautiful. From David Wyatt. Oops. From David Wyatt's. Here's on the theme of the health today. He writes, sorry, dogs are going to bark. Beauty is achieved, is an achieved state of both deep attention and self-forgetting. The self-forgetting of hearing, seeing, smelling, touching erases our separation, our distance, our fear of the other. Beauty invites us through enchantment to that fearful frontier between what makes, what we think makes us, and what we think makes the world. Beauty especially occurs in the meeting of time with timelessness, the passing moment framed by what has happened and what is about to occur, the scattering of the first spring apple blossom, the turning, spiraling flight of a curled leaf in the falling light, the smoothing of white sun-filled sheets by careful hands, setting them to air on a line, the broad expanse of cotton. Beauty is just the harvest of presence. And this way in which, when we slow down enough to pay attention, can we open up to the experience of that which is beautiful? Even when things are hard, this is distinct from the externalities in our world. Things can be really challenging or just monotonous, or some of us spoke last week, and Carlita and I were speaking about earlier, kind of a grouchiness that can come, and being able to pay attention to, okay, what's happening in the mind? Where am I orienting? Is there a way to open up into a greater sense of spaciousness and pay attention? This is from Joseph Goldstein's Mindfulness. One of the most freeing aspects of investigating the mind comes from examining our thoughts. Oh, geez. Sorry. Mostly we are lost in the movies of our mind and not even aware of the fact that we're thinking. But as we become more mindful of thought as an object of awareness, we begin to notice what we're thinking. And then on a deeper level, wisdom sees the very ephemeral, impermanent nature of thought itself, right? That line of like, what arises passes away, a thought comes. And it goes. Dogo Kense Rinpoche points to the freedom that's possible. When a rainbow appears, we see many beautiful colors. Yet a rainbow is not something we clothe ourselves with or wear as an ornament. It simply appears through a conjunction of various conditions. Thoughts arise in the mind in just the same way. They have no tangible reality or intrinsic existence at all. There is therefore no logical reason why thoughts should have so much power over us, nor any reason why we should be so enslaved by them. Once we recognize that thoughts are empty, the mind will no longer have the power to deceive us. But as long as we take our deluded thoughts as real, they will continue to torment us mercilessly, as they have been doing throughout countless past lives. I feel like I could just repeat that several times, and that could be the end of our time together, because it's just so poignant, right? Much like a rainbow, we can see like, oh my God, that's so beautiful. And we may or may not understand all the conditions of light and moisture and everything that can create that. Oh, wait, our thoughts are the same thing. And the freedom that can come, even when we can touch into it momentarily as, oh, this isn't real, right? They're ephemeral. There's no substance. And yet we can become so caught in a rigidity of thinking, a commitment to fixed views, a commitment to this is the way it is, to knowing, that we entrap ourselves, right? Or the thought patterns can be so painful. I remember, and some of you were with me when I was going through my divorce, which was terrible. And that all the machinations of the mind and anger and hurt and frustration. And sometimes I just be like, I wish I could be anywhere else but my mind, because it was so unpleasant. And so much of this energy that was just really hard to sit with, right? And that line of love that I share all the time from Annie Lamott, of the mind's like a bad neighborhood. I try not to go there alone, which is why we need other people, right? A couple of weeks ago, speaking about the extended mind and the nature of we need others. we need the companionship of others to kind of help us when we're like, ah, kind of at the, I'm kind of caught in where the thoughts can become really rigid. And when we can open up to a conversation with someone else, there's a way of like, honey, that's not true. That's not reality. And we need these wise friends around us to mirror our own goodness and be like, that's a story you're telling yourself. And many of us have stories that we were told about ourselves when we were young that didn't fit then. They certainly may not fit now. And it's sort of breaking out of stories we were told about ourselves by someone who actually wasn't standing in our own skin, and how some of them are really damaging and limiting. You know, you can't draw, you're stupid in math, you're stupid, whatever. Doesn't help someone flourish or expand, but there's a way we can really hold on to, yeah, but my third grade teacher said this. And as that third grader mind can hold on to it to being true. And the maturity of being able to be like, really? You know, for Byron Katie, is it true? Is it really true? How do you know it's true? What if it wasn't true? In this process of being able, through sitting and observing the patterns of the mind, to really look at what stories am I captivated by? Both that sort of in the mind of what we orient towards, but also what captures us. And this is back to the interview. From Donna Donahue again. A person believes that if they tell you their story, that's who they are. And sometimes these stories are constructed of the most banal, secondhand, psychological, or spiritual cliche. And you look at this beautiful, interesting face telling a story that you know doesn't hold a candle to the life that is secretly in there. So what I think happens here is a bit of a reduction of identity to a biography, and they're not the same thing. I think biography unfolds identity and makes it visible and puts a mirror of it out there. But identity is a much more complex thing. And what I love in this regard is my old friend, Meister Eckhart, the 14th century German mystic. There is a place in the soul that neither time nor space nor no created thing can touch. I'll read it again. There is a place in the soul that neither time nor space nor no created thing can touch. And he says, I thought this was really amazing. And if you cash it out, what it means is that your identity is not equivalent to your biography, and that there is a place in you where you have never been wounded, where there is still a sureness in you, where there is a seamlessness in you, where there is a confidence and tranquility in you. And I think the intention of prayer and spirituality and love is now and again to visit that inner kind of sanctuary. So beautiful, right? This inner kind of sanctuary that has never been harmed or wounded or touched or constrained. And how do we find that? So where's sort of the key to that? Part of it is this awareness. It's the awareness practice of settling in and questioning the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, questioning the stories we tell ourselves about the world, about others, the way we can collapse someone to a particular story and hold fast to it. Yeah. There's this book. Sorry. It's called Six Word Memoirs. And if anyone's, I think years ago, I would share this from time to time. And the title is not quite what I was planning. Six Word Memoirs. So I wanted to share some of these. And the invitation is, if you were to write your a memoir in six words, what might it be? And here are some funny examples. Didn't fit in then, still don't. A man, a plan, hot damn. Woke up, fell down, exited sideways. From Dancy Dunn, ABCs, MTVs, MTV, SATs, THC, IRA, NPR. Meat and potatoes man goes vegetarian. Smart, tall, independent woman, men scarce. I was, and now I'm not. Quite undecided, yet hopefully unsatisfied generally. took a spectacle, made it sport. Slightly psychotic in a good way. As a child, nomadic, now static. And the last one, mushrooms, clowns, wands, five, wig, thatched. I'm enjoying even this downward dance. I think I'm going to stop there and have us move into an exercise if you're game. So I'm going to invite you to close your eyes. And again, to just reflect back perhaps on if you did use thoughts as your anchor for the sit, what are some patterns that you are aware of? Oh, when I'm quiet, the thinking mind can go to planning or comparing or judging or list making, or whatever. And just sort of being curious, not needing to know the answer per se, but just having that question linger a little bit. What are the patterns of the mind? And again, it's this curiosity. Can we become more intimate with the movements, the rhythms, the waves of the thinking mind, such that we are not enslaved by them? We are not entrapped by them. We're not ruled by them. But we can start to see more clearly the ephemeral nature. They arise. They pass away, much like that rainbow. The thoughts may be beautiful. They may be destructive. They arise and they pass away. And I don't think I will ever cease to be amazed at the power of this practice to be able to develop the muscle that can say, it's just a thought. I don't have to believe it. I don't have to react to it. Just watch it. So there's an expansive possibility there of being able to understand and be in conversation with the thinking mind from a different vantage point of, okay, there's enough space here to hold that which will come and go. And if we can hold on to, embrace perhaps the notion that a biography is not destiny. Biography does not create who we are. It sets up opportunities for that, who we truly are, to emerge. Yeah. So to play the invitation here, if we play a little bit with a story of our biography, that is liberatory. It's not the story of what happened to me when I was a kid. It's not a story that is basing itself in the traumas or the negativity. But if you were to write a memoir in six words of the liberatory aspects of your life, and what words come? What might those six words be? And we'll take a little bit of time here to, if you're a game, to kind of play with, if we look at our own biography, the narrative, the typical narrative we might give someone as we're getting to know somebody. And can we look for those junctures, those thresholds, those doorways that we walk through that allowed, that provided some liberation, some freedom, some opening? It doesn't mean it was easy. Generally, those are really painful times. And what happens if from wherever we are in our life now, kind of look, casting an eye back to look for those thresholds, that allowed us to expand into our best selves, allowed us to expand into ourselves, to come home to ourselves, our true self, not the person we're trying to present to the world. What would it be like to string 6 words together that might capture those different thresholds, those different doorways that allowed us to open up to our lives? And to take the next step of forward looking, how might we want to create thresholds and doorways that allow us to continually expand into our true self? That's one motion, expanding out, which I believe so truly is also coming back home, resting in what we know to be true about ourselves. Those 6 words be. I ask you to kind of keep playing after the class is over with this idea of the 6-word memoir in a way that captures points in your life where you really got to connect to the beauty and strength that is your innate goodness. So stop there and thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.